Stand by while NCLA cuts through the noise to signal abuse of administrative power. This is Administrative Static with Mark Chenoweth and John Vecchione.
This is John Vecchione. I'm here with Mark Chenoweth. Welcome to Administrative Static. We have a interesting week as far as Justice Breyer is concerned. He has been subject to a lot of calls for retire. He's 82, and many Democrats believe that Justice Ginsburg hung on too long, and she was replaced by a Republican president, put someone in there, and they don't want that to happen. So they've been putting huge pressure on Breyer while they control the Senate and the presidency to retire. Justice Breyer has not lost a step, in my estimation. I mean, I've seen him, and what I'm about to talk about, I just saw him give a rather long and intricate speech for Harvard. And it's pretty clear that he is not slowing down. So I don't know where those calls are going to come from, or what's going to happen, or what he'll do. Everybody will wait. You know, when the court is done in June, everyone looks for the retirement announcements. And he's under pressure, but he certainly seems to be deep in the game to me.
Has he hired his full complement of clerks? That's sometimes exactly the tea leaf reading.
That's a tea leaf reading. But I watched a lot of his speech. Now, here's what happened. So, of course, everything's in Zoom. Nobody's showing up for anything. But he actually went and put on a coat and tie and gave a talk, which is pretty interesting. It was called The Supreme Court and the Perils of Politics. And he explicitly said, Mark and I have discussed court packing, which is the partisan effort to simply expand the size of the Supreme Court so you can put ideologically aligned people with the president and whoever was running Congress at the time on the court and drown out the votes of the people who were there already. And it's kind of interesting. So Harvard has a lecture every year, a Scalia lecture. This is like the 21st year. I mean, they've been doing it since, Scalia was alive when they started it. And Justice Breyer decided to do the talk. And he said, this lecture reflects my own effort to be certain that those who debate proposals, meaning reform proposals for the court, also consider an important institutional point, namely, how would court packing reflect and affect the rule of law itself? And I found it very interesting because one of the things that concerns some folks is how often the justices talk to law judges in other countries. And there's certainly the concern that they're, overly influenced by foreign law and the way foreign courts do things. But the reverse is often true in that foreign courts, particularly younger courts or newer Supreme Courts, look to our Supreme Court for guidance. And the Supreme Chief Justice of Ghana came here to visit them, our Supreme Court justices, and she asked Justice Breyer, why do people follow your orders? Why does anyone in the country? And this speech that he gave, and it's on the web, I mean, I just go to Harvard.edu and Supreme Court Justice Breyer, and you can get it. And he says, well, that's an interesting question. And the answer to that question is the Constitution was put in, and the founders put in the Supreme Court to determine all areas of law. And then certain things happened whereby the court sort of built for itself a reputation so that people began to trust it. And he uses a lot of examples. And I think what he's saying, he's really talking to the court packers saying, listen, it's not, it's, it's a different institution if you do that. The reason we're able to say the things we say and be followed, it's not because we have magical powers. He didn't say that. Those are my words. It's not because we have magical powers. It's because certain trust has been built up. And how has it been built up? And he uses Marbury versus Madison, which famously, first of all, it's in the 1800s. The court was going on for a while there. There were like three Supreme Court justices before Marshall, and they didn't have a big impact. But Marshall said that, in fact, that Thomas Jefferson couldn't take away Marbury's commission. But on the other hand, the law that allowed them to review it was unconstitutional. So he didn't have to order Thomas Jefferson to do anything. So what he did was he put down the marker that the Supreme Court gets to say what the law is, but then he didn't push it, which Breyer says, well, you know, that built up some of our strength. But then he brings up the Cherokees, and the Cherokee, they found gold on Cherokee land in Georgia, and the Georgia legislature just moved to take it from them and give it to settlers. And the Supreme Court ruled against them. The Supreme Court ruled for the Cherokees with absolutely no effect, absolutely no effect. And so I think that those two examples show that the Supreme Court can do all the good and do the right thing, but if no one's listening to them, it matters. It matters a lot. So
President Jackson famously said, John Marshall has made his decision. Now let him enforce it.
Now let him enforce it. Exactly. And I do think that is it's important to remember this. And it's important that it comes from Justice Breyer, because he's an old D.C. hand. He used to be he used to work for Ted Kennedy. And the way he got on the bench was he was very respected by everybody in the Senate. He'd been Senator Kennedy's Massachusetts, not the Louisiana one now, the old Senator Kennedy. And he had been his judiciary guy, and he worked on the sentencing guidelines and a bunch of other things. And he got appointed, and he came in, and he knows how Washington works. And he does, I think he's sending a message to his own side that they are doing things that are not going to help any outcome they want, because you know, if a packed court orders something, people might resist it, and it might lead to a weakening of the court. Which, what does that do? That just helps who's ever in power, because if the Congress and the president could do what they want with no checks on them, it becomes a different country pretty quick.
Not only was Breyer confirmed, but he was confirmed after Reagan was elected. He was confirmed later in November of 1980. To the First Circuit, so
the First Circuit, right? Not to the Supreme Court.
To the Supreme Court. No, the Supreme Court was what, 94, I think.
Yeah. So that is exactly right. I just
mentioned that because people might consider that court packing to confirm someone after a president has been of the other party has been elected.
That is true, but I think one of the reasons they were able to do that without a big ruckus is because the senators at the time, the Republican senators, did not do any goal line stands on Breyer. They knew him.
Right. So right.
I think that was they may not have liked that maneuver, but they didn't cause a big ruckus because they felt that Breyer was part of the. Someone they knew and they didn't think was crazy. So
and that happens even today. The folks who are Senate staffers a lot of times get an easier right. pass in the Senate confirmation process, whether it's for a judicial nomination or something else, just the familiarity. But I just looked this up. So Jimmy Carter nominated Breyer on November 13th, 1980. He was confirmed by the Senate on December 9th, 1980. So a different time.
The thing is, what do you think, Mark? The fix must have been in for that to happen. I have to think that this was long in the works or something.
Well, Kennedy, I think, as you say, he was a Kennedy staffer. I think Kennedy was the chairman of the of the Judiciary Committee. So I think it just, I think Kennedy had the votes, right? I mean, that's what
right.
It was.
And it was going to turn over, right? That's
it was going to turn over, yeah.
Six Republicans came in, right? So it was going to be turned over. Oh, that's funny. I hadn't thought of it like that. So, yeah, so they got him on, and then Clinton appointed him some years later. He was a judge for a while, though. But I think that it's important, and I think Mark and I talk about this a lot, is that you have to have your theory of judging and then how the processes that affect the Supreme Court are done by the other branches is important. You can't just make new rules because you want new outcomes. That's exactly the opposite of the rule of law, exactly the opposite. And I think that that Breyer is telling his own side, listen, don't do this. Now, one of the things that might make them less likely to do that is if he retires and they get to put someone in his spot, which he also may not want to do, because I think it's hard to leave. You know, since 1970, our justices have stayed a lot longer than prior. They're appointed younger, and our lifespans have increased. So you've got a lot of judges. Breyer will join the club this year of the 25 longest serving Supreme Court justices. He will be one of the top 25, and I'm sure he'll go up the rankings pretty quick.
Well, and the justices who have left, like Sandra Day O'Connor, have said it was a mistake to retire when they did. So you've got that on the other side. You've got the Ginsburg example on the one side, but the O'Connor example on the other side.
That's right. And she felt she had a lot more to offer. And she stayed. She did stay. And, you know, I've had cases before Justice Souter, you know. So it's interesting. I recommend the speech to everybody if you're interested in that sort of thing. And we'll be back.
Welcome back to Administrative Static. Mark Chenoweth here with John Vecchione. And Vec, I wanted to talk about something that we almost got to last week, but we ended up having to put it off a week. But this is a comment that the New Civil Liberties Alliance filed with FinCEN. And FinCEN is the Financial Crimes Enforcement Network at the U.S. Department of Treasury. And it's called FinCEN for short, usually capital F, small I, small N, capital C, capital E, capital N, FinCEN. And FinCEN's a bureau of the Department of Treasury. The director of FinCEN is appointed by the Secretary of the Treasury. And the mission of FinCEN is to safeguard the financial system from illicit use, to combat money laundering, to promote national security. And they do this by collecting, analyzing, and disseminating financial intelligence to financial authorities throughout the government. They receive and maintain financial transactions data. They analyze and disseminate that data to law enforcement, and they cooperate with their counterparts in other countries around the world to make this happen. And the particular regulation that FinCEN has proposed and that NCLA has objected to is called Requirements for Certain Transactions Involving Convertible Virtual Currency or Digital Assets. And this was proposed on December 23rd of 2020. And for those who might want to look it up, it's 85 Fed Reg 83840. But the gist of this proposed FinCEN rule is to bring digital currency, to bring Bitcoin and Ethereum and other cryptocurrencies underneath the auspices of FinCEN. And what I mean by that is there are all sorts of federal laws that currently apply to bank transactions that do not apply to digital currency transactions. And that's one of the reasons that some people use digital currency, I'm sure. But so, for example, if you do a transaction and the dollar amount here may have shifted, but I think it used to be $10,000. It may be less than that now. But if you conduct a bank transaction in an amount at or above $10,000, then the bank has to fill out a form. And so if you, for example, if you bring in $10,000 in cash to deposit in your personal checking account, the bank has to fill out a form and tell the government that you've conducted this $10,000 transaction. And if you deposit $10,000 of Bitcoin, or you receive $10,000 of Bitcoin and maybe move that from one account to another or cash it out or what have you, that is not a reportable transaction, or at least that's my understanding under the Bank Secrecy Act. And when I say the Bank Secrecy Act, I should quickly point out there is not one federal law that's called the Bank Secrecy Act. There's a whole bunch of different federal statutes that have that interrelate and have to do with this area of the law. And those who follow this much more closely than I do have just used the term Bank Secrecy Act to sort of encompass this this whole interrelated amalgam of federal statutes. So I don't want to throw anybody off by referring to this one law.
But so anyway, you're not gonna find the Bank Secrecy Act at 18 U.S.C. 25,000 or whatever it is.
I don't think so. I think it's a more colloquial term.
Yeah, I don't believe so either. I don't know anything about the electronic coinage and the bitcoins, but one of those Bank Secrecy Acts that you just said about the $10,000, the word that I always love from the bank secrecy area is that if you try to get under the $10,000 limit and you deposit like $3,500, you know, three times, or you put in $9,950, the term for that, it's illegal and you can be put in jail for it. And it's called, for some reason, smurfing. And I wonder if you can smurf a Bitcoin. Go ahead.
I'm familiar with the verb to smurf, but it's been used at least in the blue cartoon character TV show. They use smurf as a verb for lots of different things.
But I guess so.
Yeah. But anyway, the financial structuring, I think, is the other term that's used for that conduct. And one of the things that people object to about this proposed regulation is that it would do the same thing in the digital realm. If the government believed that you were structuring your digital transactions to avoid these automatic reports being generated about transactions in a certain amount occurring, then you would be committing a federal crime. And that actually gets into why NCLA has objected and filed comments against this regulation as well. And really, there are other things to object to about this regulation, but the two things that we have focused on in our comments are, first of all, that this proposed rule exceeds appropriate constitutional limits because it empowers FinCEN to exercise what amounts to legislative power. Congress has not passed a law that gives FinCEN this ability or gives the U.S. Treasury this ability. They have not modified or extended the various statutes that are part of the Bank Secrecy Act to encompass digital transactions. And that's really incumbent upon Congress. Congress is the entity in the federal government that has the constitutional power and authority to do that. By instead having FinCEN reclassify digital assets, we think that exceeds the power. That's exercising the exclusive legislative power that only belongs to Congress. FinCEN is not filling in details in existing law, but rather it is writing a new rule on a new subject, and worse yet, one that has criminal consequences. So that's a problem from a constitutional standpoint. And I should say, too, that this is not something that's within the inherent power of the executive branch. So there are certain things that the president or other executive branch folks can do, even if Congress hasn't written a law to empower it, just because it's part of the natural powers or inherent powers of the president or other executive officers. But that's not true here. Creating a whole new type of criminal liability is a uniquely legislative act, and therefore not something that FinCEN or the Treasury Department or the U.S. Secretary of the Treasury can do without a legislative warrant to do it. So that's problem number one. Problem number two, from our perspective, is that the rule violates the Fourth Amendment against unreasonable searches and seizures, because it extends the reach of these Bank Secrecy Act rules and regulations to require production of sensitive financial information from people who have never voluntarily disclosed that information to a financial institution. And why does that matter? Well, let me take a step back. So you might think, well, why isn't the Bank Secrecy Act already a Fourth Amendment violation? Why is it not already the case that that folks don't have privacy in their financial dealings with the bank? Well, good question. And the Supreme Court has said about that in a maybe less than satisfying to some account of the constitutional principles at stake here, that you have voluntarily disclosed this financial information. So when you deposit money in the bank, you have told the bank that you have that money, essentially. And because you've shared that information with a third party, i.e. the bank, then the fact that the bank turns around and shares that information with the government, it's not really private. You can't really expect to have privacy over that information from the government because you've already shared it with the bank. Now, you may not like that explanation. You may not agree with that account of your Fourth Amendment rights from the Supreme Court, but that's the state of the law. But when it comes to Bitcoin or these digital currencies, this information has not been shared with the banks. Now, it has been shared with various Bitcoin brokerages and private, they call them unhosted wallets. Sometimes there are various ways of moving currency around and keeping track of it that don't involve, first of all, don't involve banks, but second of all, preserve your anonymity. And so these private wallets or what have you, they may be aware of the amount or of the password that's attached to a certain amount of money, et cetera, but they may not know who owns that password or where it goes and so forth. So there's more anonymity there. And so folks have not voluntarily disclosed to a financial institution the fact that they, you know, own this Bitcoin or cryptocurrency or have these assets and so forth. And I should say, you still have an obligation to pay your taxes on this and so forth. That doesn't go away. And there may be some folks who are illicitly using Bitcoin or other cryptocurrencies in order to conduct illegal financial transactions. And when that happens, the government is already able to go after those folks and arrest them, hold them accountable, throw them in prison for whatever illegality they're involved in. But it is presumably more difficult for the government to track folks who are structuring their transactions using cryptocurrencies rather than using banks and more standard kinds of financial transaction methods. But does the fact that it's more difficult for the government to find people who are doing illicit activity give them a right to violate the Fourth Amendment rights of folks who are not engaged in any illicit activity? If you are an innocent owner of Bitcoin or Ethereum or some other cryptocurrency, why should the government evict? I started to ask you a question, but we're getting close to the end of the segment. So let me just say, it doesn't make sense to me that just that when there's no reasonable suspicion, there's no warrant, there's nothing that the government would ordinarily have to get in order to get your information, that FinCEN can now get this by putting out this regulation. They can just avoid the Fourth Amendment. That doesn't make any sense to me. And because of those two objections, NCLA has discouraged FinCEN from going forward with this rulemaking. We'll see if that has any effect. We'll see if there is a final rule, if it's different from the proposed rule. But we thought that our listeners would want to hear about this, we think, unconstitutional new rule. We'll be back.